The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney, and in this episode of the Cycling Podcast, you're going to hear a conversation between me and Daniel Freeb. Because a couple of weeks ago, on the Giro d'Italia rest day in Abruzzo, Daniel and I sat down with a pre-prandial glass of white wine to talk about a project that has, just like a fine wine itself, taken a number of years to mature. Daniel's biography of the German cyclist Jan Ullrich is published this week. It's called The Best There Never Was, and it's been years in the making. There was the research and writing that goes into any book project, of course, but also a sense of responsibility to the subject, who has had some very well-publicised difficulties with depression and alcohol use in the years since his retirement. It's an intriguing subject because Ullrich burst onto the scene in 1996 when, as a relative unknown, he finished second in the Tour de France behind his telecom teammate Bjarne Riis. The following year, still aged only 23, Ullrich won the Tour by 9 minutes, and it seemed as if the sport was in for an era of total domination by the German. After that, though, Ullrich's career did not run smoothly. There was an era of domination, of course. Lance Armstrong came back from cancer and won the Tour 7 times in a row. Ullrich was the nearly man of that era, second to Armstrong 3 times, third once, and fourth once. And when the American retired the first time round in 2005, Ullrich looked set for a battle with Ivan Basso for the right to assume Armstrong's crown. Except neither he nor Basso got the chance because both were revealed to be clients of the blood-doping doctor Eufemiano Fuentes, and they left Strasbourg in disgrace on the eve of the 2006 Tour de France. Ullrich never raced again. I was really interested to hear from Daniel about the process of writing the book, and first of all, why he wanted to write about Jan Ullrich. Well, Daniel, why did you want to write a book about Jan Ullrich?
Straight to the point, Lionel. No preamble.
No preamble.
Good to see you too. Good to speak. Why a book about Jan Ullrich? Well, this is probably a long answer, complicated answer. As it was a complicated process to write this book, I have to take my mind back to when I decided to do this in 2015. I'd written a few books in the years leading up to that. And, well, as a few of us had, you know, it was a fertile time, wasn't it, for cycling publishing, particularly in the UK. There was a big appetite for it. Jan Ullrich was, at that time, I mean, he'd disappeared from view in 2006 when he disappeared from the Tour de France, on the eve of the Tour de France. He'd effectively left the Tour de France in disgrace before it had started. So in 2015, it'd been 9 years since that had happened, and he'd really disappeared from public view. Certainly as far as non-Germans were concerned, there were a lot of legal issues arising from what happened in 2006, but not that much information about what was going on with Jan Ullrich. So there was a mystery there to unpick what had happened with his life. From the start, this was going to be the story not only of Jan Ullrich but of German cycling, of this spectacular boom and then bust, which we'd all witnessed, and it left us all open mouthed, really, because while in other countries the sport's reputation had suffered as a result of doping scandals, in Germany everything had really been obliterated, turned to absolute dust. All the teams had gone, the races had almost all gone, and I don't mean just road races, I mean the six-day scene, which was a mainstay of cycling in Germany, had almost been obliterated as well. So that needed to be unpicked, what had happened in Germany, why that reaction had happened in Germany. But then going back to why Jan Ullrich, I sort of got into cycling as a teenager in the mid-90s. There was no connection with cycling at all in my family. And the main connection for me was, it was an intersection of various interests, geography, foreign languages, sport. And 1996, 97, 98, those were the years when I was first getting interested in cycling. In 1996, Jan Ullrich appeared from nowhere, really, and finished second in the Tour de France behind his telecom teammate, Bjarne Riis. And then 1997, I was on holiday in Italy, actually, and I was watching the tour, I sort of would take an hour or two out in the afternoon and I would watch with my dad, although my dad wasn't that interested in cycling. We saw Jan Ulrich win in Andorra. And at 16 or 17, you're incredibly impressionable. And it was, as I say, it was really the second Tour de France I'd properly watched. And it just seemed like this absolutely momentous moment when Ulrich went away in Andorra and crushed everyone. And by today's standards, 23 doesn't sound that precocious by the standards of the last few years. But for a 23-year-old to do that was extraordinary. And even then, without me knowing the context of, you know, at 17, I'm not even sure I knew that the record of Tours de France was five. The Anquetil had got five, Hinault had got five. Even then, I think I immediately deduced that this guy was going to win lots of Tours de France. He was going to mark an era. And I think only later did I realise that that's what a lot of people were saying. That's what a lot of very qualified people were saying, including the likes of Hinault. I think Hinault said that he was going to win 10 Tours de France. And that didn't seem that outlandish. It seems outlandish now. Then he went on to win that Tour de France by 9 minutes. And it was a really significant Tour de France because, I don't know if you'll agree, but it was the last Tour de France certainly for the next 20 years, when I think people watched with kind of untainted, unvarnished, uncaveated awe at what they were seeing. The first thing that came to people's head wasn't a question mark when they saw an incredible exploit. It should have been, because doping was rampant at that point. But the wool was only really pulled out of people's eyes a year later with Festina. So it was the last tour that I think people watched in that spirit of being just flabbergasted by what they were seeing. And you know, the imagery as well, again, when you're 16, 17, everything's more vivid, everything's more powerful. But this, you know, this fresh-faced, ginger-haired, freckle-faced young guy that no one really knew that much about in this beautiful, clean, white German national champions jersey. And I may or may not have known that he was from East Germany, and this was not that far out from the unification of Germany. And he was a symbol of the United Germany. And, you know, It was vivid, it was compelling, it was powerful, it was moving, and it carried the promise of, as I said, redefining the sport of cycling for the next however many years. And that, I never really lost that, although I went on not long later, 4 years later, I was covering the sport. And Ulrich was a bit of an enigma for most people because German's not a commonly spoken language among, you know, the rest of Europe. So everything that Ulrich said was always through a filter. He wasn't very articulate either, particularly. So we never really knew that much about him. And then, of course, he was completely overshadowed by Armstrong. But to me, and I think to a lot of other people, the sort of affection, the awe, the interest, the intrigue, the mystique, they remained. And there's also that thing which, you know, you see in a lot of sports and you probably see in other domains like music, when someone does something absolutely, one, that they offer a glimpse of something transcendental, prodigious, incredible, and it's a tantalizing glimpse because it's never repeated. And that was the case with Ulrich. That makes such a magnetic story. People love those stories, and it applies to a certain extent to people, you know, when sports people or musicians, when they die early, when they die prematurely as well. It happened with Pantani. People are left with the longing for what may have been. And that's really the story of Ulrich's career.
Yeah, I do agree with you about looking at the 1997 Tour de France through innocent eyes. I mean, it was the last one I watched before I started working in cycling at a magazine. And I actually went to the tour with my dad that year, and we went and watched the time trial in Saint-Étienne. And we stood on the climb, and I'm interested to know what it was about Ulrich that appealed, because I went completely the other way. Like, I went for the romantics, you know, Virenque and Pantani, who kind of danced up the climb, losing time, and Ulrich came up the climb in the saddle, looking like a machine, and he ticked all of those kind of stereotypical German, robotic almost, you know, the German football team that always wins on penalties, the sort of relentless machine-like quality. And I suppose, again, having watched the Olympic Games and sort of absorb some of the cynicism of perhaps the British coverage towards the East German and Soviet teams. There was a sense of the sort of East German machine sort of infecting Western European sport, pure Western European sport. So it's interesting to me that you went for the kind of the power and awe of Jan Ullrich, while I was kind of with the sort of, you know, dandelion pickers, you know, the Veronks and the Pantanis, who, like I say, just to me, you know, they look like Tour de France cycling, and Jan Ullrich almost didn't look like a cyclist in those first couple of years. He was bigger, he was just awesome power, but in a different way to Indurain, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think in those first couple of years, so in 96, when he finished second, 97, there was a litheness about him. There was a, I mean, he was certainly very light. He finished those tours at about 69 kilos, and that was a weight he would never get back to. And he was elegant. I think he was elegant. And when I go back now and watch Andorra, I see less of that elegance than I think I saw then. He does look, you know, he's powerful. But you can also see it sort of foreshadows the sort of lumbering diesel engine that we saw later when he was a little bit overweight. You can kind of see how he turned into that. But at the time, I just saw this fluid, this beautiful, aesthetically very appealing athlete. And again, you know, the imagery and the intangibles. We've talked about this before, the way someone's name rolls off your tongue, maybe the fact that he was mysterious. And the story also changed very quickly with Ullrich. The story, the narrative changed from this robotic, taciturn, inscrutable, you know, dominant figure who was going to win the tour for many years to come. Within months, almost within weeks, in fact, the story became something completely different when he started to put on weight in the winter of, well, the 97 to 98 winter. And he almost became a comedic figure, a tragicomic figure. And that was really the narrative for the rest of his career, as far as a lot of people were concerned.
So as you say, Daniel, in 2015, when you came up with this idea, pitched it and got a publishing deal, Jan Ullrich was kind of off the radar. But in the years that it's taken you to research and write the book, he's kind of emerged as a public figure again, and he's had sort of public difficulties, hasn't he? I mean, we've talked on the podcast about how long this book has taken to get to the point where it's ready to be published. I mean, what was the beginning of the process like, and why did it take you so long to write the book? I mean, that's not a dig. Books take a long time to research and write properly.
This is going to be a long answer.
I think you would say
this could be a seven year long answer.
It took longer than you'd anticipated at the time.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I started off at the rhythm I sort of had been going out with other books. You know, I wrote an Eddie Merckx biography that it was supposed to take a very short amount of time, I think 9 months or so, and then because another British journalist, William Fotheringham, was writing one at the same time, the publisher moved it forward 3 months. And as I say, it was a very prolific time for cycling books in the UK, and there were publishers that did want them, and they wanted them quickly. So in 2015, I started well. You know, I went to, the first person I think I interviewed was Lance Armstrong. I went to Texas and spent a day with him playing golf, which was fantastic. We gave me a fantastic interview, and you know, he's a big figure in the book. I mean, which will make people wince. Some people won't like it, but his recollections, his storytelling is really pitch perfect, both as a reflection of him, who he was, who he is now, less so because the interview was in 2015.
Just tell me about the golf. I mean, did you pull your punches in the golf to ensure that he would open up a bit? Or, bad luck, I seem to have missed that one from 6 inches, Lance, your hole.
No, it was quite a close game. I didn't play much golf these days, and back then he was playing 250 days a year, I think. It was actually a period, it's interesting to see the transition he's gone through in terms of his relationship with cycling, because I remember on our game of golf, I was asking him, you know, how much time he spent at his bike shop, Mellow Johnny's, and I remember him saying something like, oh, I never go there. And I said, why not? And he said, well, I might meet a cyclist. And that, I think that reflected, you know, his embarrassment at the time. It was fairly soon after the whole Oprah Winfrey, you know, and the meltdown that followed. So, you know, I started that spring in 2015, did a lot of interviews, really, you know, interviews that were necessary, very necessary, but people who had not spoken at all since 2006, since Ulrich had been exposed or not spoken in any great depth. Rudy Pevenage, his director sportif at Telecom, he'd given a couple of interviews with L'Équipe, but there was a lot that he hadn't said. He was also quite cagey with me, but anyway, that spring, I sort of knocked off, I might have had a list of 60 or 70 people, and I maybe knocked off 20, 30 of them. And then also that summer, I moved to Berlin, I went to Berlin for the first time for 2 or 3 months because I wanted to change a few things in my life, but I also realised it would be really good for the book, and it was necessary for the book. I'd never lived in Germany before. I spoke A-level German, but I hadn't really spoken it for years. And I knew that to get under the skin of this subject matter that I would have to speak German. You know, there were a lot of people, for example, Ulrich's first coach, Peter Becker, you know, certainly didn't speak English. And there were a lot of people, older people, who, you know, for whom it would be necessary to speak German, and also just to understand the culture and understand, you know, how people live in Germany, how people see themselves in Germany. So yeah, and I went through that summer and late summer again with a few months in Berlin, and it was going along quite quickly. But I got to sort of October and November, and the book was due in December or January. And, you know, to be honest, I mean, I started working as a journalist in 2001, and straight away I found it very, very difficult, and I had a what in layman's terms would be described as a big breakdown straight away, really, in a few months in. And I'd never really recovered from that, in spite of, you know, working in lots of different ways to write what was wrong, you know. And I found it incredibly, incredibly difficult to meet deadlines. I couldn't meet any deadline because of health issues. You know, I'm loath to just put it down to sort of mental health. I mean, it was a kind of trauma, and I'd never got over that, but I'd sort of hidden it, and I'd managed to build a career in spite of that. I had enough, you know, I could speak foreign languages. There were aspects of the job that I could do, in spite of not functioning very well. And this had gone on for over 10 years, and I'd written books in the meantime, and they'd absolutely broken me. You know, I'd be up until 2 o'clock in the morning, getting up at 6 in the morning, and still only managing to write what a normal person would write in, you know, a couple of hours. And this had gone on for years and years, and I'd got to the point where I realised this couldn't continue. You know, I was in my mid-30s, and it was just going to continue if I didn't sort it out. So I just pressed pause, and I decided that I was still going to write the book. But it also, you know, it was a delicate story. It was a sensitive story. I wanted to do it justice. I wanted to do him justice, because it's a big responsibility writing about someone's life and someone who'd been through an awful lot. And it wasn't fair to him to half-arse it, for want of a better word. It wasn't fair to the story. It wasn't fair to readers as well. So basically decided that the book was going to happen, but it was only going to happen when I felt that I could do it some justice. The problem was that process then took, well, if you'd asked me then, I might have said it would have taken 6 months. It took 6 or 7 years. The other dimension to that is that, you know, as things were improving for me and I was sort of dealing with some of the issues and getting to the point where, you know, I could work on it again, parallel to this, Jan Ulrich was having a lot of issues in his personal life. And this culminated in 2018 in what I think a lot of people are aware of, this awful summer of complete self-immolation with, you know, problems with alcohol, drugs, well publicized. He spoke about them in himself. And as I say, just as I was getting to the point where, you know, I was maybe a few months away from finishing the book, it became really, really sensitive. And I had really mixed feelings about continuing with the project, despite my absolute determination to see it through, just for myself, really, as well. But I felt like I had China in my hand, really. And I didn't know how to approach it sensitively. I had to work out how to be tactful, how to, well, not further imperil him, because, you know, I mean, you know this yourself, Lionel, to a large extent, once you write a book and you put it out into the world, you lose control of it. And I was very aware as well that this was a book that might be, you know, if it wasn't going to be translated in German, things would be picked up in the German press. And I'd seen over, you know, 3 or 4 years of working on the book, how things that, you know, had played out in the media had possibly, I couldn't be sure, but how they possibly affected him and his mental health. They'd certainly not helped him. And I couldn't, you know, my intention when I started this project was, what my motives were compassionate, really. And that's my default position about that generation. I mean, it's my default position. I think it's yours as well as a journalist. I mean, I'm kind of loath generally to judge sports people and their morals. And I try to have quite a light touch around that kind of thing. So, you know, that I'd set my stall out to write that kind of book and to restore some honour in a certain way, because there were riders from his generation who had been rehabilitated, and there was an injustice to that, the way they'd been rehabilitated, yet he was still living in this kind of exile where he couldn't step back out into the public domain. And the only reason he couldn't really was because he didn't have the words, he wasn't articulate enough, he didn't have the gift of the gab, but he was embarrassed, he probably felt a little bit of shame. So I had wanted to restore some sort of dignity to the story in a way, and I could hardly, well, if I was going to do that, I had to be very, very scrupulous about the way I was going to do it. And I couldn't, you know, to put a book out there and say, well, okay, this is wrong, this is maybe a bit insensitive, but I personally, as the writer of the book, wasn't feeling great at that time, so you have to let me off for that, it wasn't really gonna fly.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. As you'll probably know by now, Super Sapiens monitors your blood glucose levels in real time so you can manage your energy resources better, train better, recover better, and perform better. You can learn how to turn the data into lasting positive behaviour changes that allow for better glucose control and in turn for better performance. If you want to find out more about Super Sapiens, go to supersapiens.com. I just wanted to pick up on something you said about Ulrich's career. I mean, he reached this incredible height in 1997. He won the Tour by a huge margin, and it did look like he would win multiple Tours in a row. And yet, 12 months later, the vulnerability that I had wished to see in 97 was incredibly apparent.
Yes. It was incredibly apparent, and some of it was very understandable. I mean, we always talk, don't we, Lionel, about when someone wins a Tour for the first time, there's always the debate and the question. That's just some wine being poured, should anyone wonder. There's always the question, how they're going to deal with it. And we always assume that it's difficult. We always talk about the same things. We talk about them going to parties, dinners, ceremonies, that kind of thing. And that it's always a difficult period to negotiate. And it was for Ulrich. It was very, very difficult, I think, for him. And he was fated. I mean, he was the first German Tour de France winner. Shortly after the Tour de France in 1997, Der Spiegel, which is one of the biggest news magazines in Germany, voted him, or there was a survey that they conducted, he was voted the greatest German sportsman of all time, having just won one Tour de France. Now, there was a bit of recency bias in that because Steffi Graf had just had a terrible year, Boris Becker had had a bad year, Michael Schumacher had had a bad year. Nonetheless, that gives you an idea of the sort of Ulrich fever. The other thing that happened in 1997 after he won the Tour was that for the rest of that summer, he won pretty much every race he took part in. And this even included races like the Hamburg one day race, which was not a course that was suited to him. So he just kept winning. And what then started to happen, even late in that season, there were a couple of races that he went to and he didn't win. And he got booed at a couple of races for not winning. So, you know, I think he got a sense really quickly of how big the whole thing was, and I think it stressed him out. He wasn't someone that necessarily enjoyed the spotlight. You know, he did a lot of criteriums after the 1997 Tour, and Jens Heppner, his teammate, who would go with him to these criteriums, you know, told me stories about how Jan would kind of be hiding behind Heppner, you know, hiding from the crowds, and there was this there was an event that Heppner used to own a cheese shop, and there was they organised this signing at the cheese shop, and they told the local police that 50 people would come, and it was, and then 5,000 people turned up, and Ulrich had to like hide under the table, and all of these things, you know, they created a lot of stress. And then in the winter, whether it was because he was enjoying himself or whether he was eating and not training as a reaction to the stress, no one really knows. Lots of people had different views on that. He did start to put on a lot of weight. Now, he'd put on quite a lot of weight in the winters, in some of the winters prior to that, but never, I mean, again, I sort of canvassed various opinions on this, and his coach Peter Becker told me that he put on over 20 kilos. That wasn't reported at the time. I think it was more like, it was 12, 15 was the sort of ballpark figure. I mean, you could see it, couldn't you, Lionel? When he showed up to, whether it was the team presentation or the first races of the season, it was very obvious that he wasn't just slightly overweight, and his results showed it as well. And then he would get, well, this was the first time it had happened, but then the pattern was just repeated almost every year. He would be overweight, then he would get ill. And then in the spring, he would go on these incredible training purges, binges, where he would, you know, I heard so many stories from people of how he would do these 200 kilometer rides on just an apple. And this would go on for weeks and weeks and weeks. And when you hear it now, it was quite obvious why he couldn't compete with Armstrong in the Tour, because, you know, it wasn't good quality training at all. It was purely to lose weight. And generally speaking, it worked in the sense that, I mean, you know, Lionel, when you would show up to the tour presentation, everyone would be sort of wowed by how thin he had managed to get. He still wasn't necessarily as thin as Armstrong, as lean as Armstrong, but a transformation had always occurred in the previous 6 or 8 weeks.
Ulrich's weight was a story, though, right from the start. I mean, I remember, I don't want to say which newspaper it was, because I couldn't honestly say which paper it was, but one of the European papers had a kind of cartoon, a square with each of the sort of main riders, you know, whether it's Virenque, Pantani, whoever, you know, their winter training, they were all on their bikes, and the bottom square was Ulrich eating some Black Forest gâteau. And so it was already a kind of caricature that Ulrich spent the winter eating. And that was, yeah, that would have been 98-99. And, 98, the Tour, he was the favourite. He was in contention until multiple factors, you know, the cold weather maybe caught up with him, back-to-back difficult days, and, you know, once the racer got into the mountains, he blew up spectacularly, didn't he? And Marco Pantani saved the Tour de France after the Festina doping scandal. And again, my sympathies swung completely the other way. I saw Ulrich having a hard time and, you know, finishing well down the Tour over for him. And then watching him kind of fight his way through the remaining stages and kind of restoring some kind of pride and dignity and what have you. And my sympathies completely switched to Ulrich. Mm. But I mean, it was a spectacular unravelling from 12 months previously, wasn't it?
Yes, it really was. As you say, from a position of everyone thinking that there was no one who was going to even come close to competing with him, finishing second in that Tour de France. And then what no one could have foreseen at that time was Armstrong looming in 1999. And Armstrong was the rider who was going to define, he was going to condemn Ulrich to the role and the image of also-ran perennial bridesmaid for the rest of his career, really.
But this is where it gets interesting, isn't it? Because Armstrong had come back. He'd had a very solid Vuelta at the end of 98. And then one by one, all of the potential contenders for the Tour de France seemed to just fall out of contention. I mean, Pantani got busted for a high hematocrit at the tail end of the Giro, so he was out of contention. And Ulrich was basically having troubles of his own and was unable to start the Tour in 99.
Yes, Lionel, and well, in fact, the book is divided into two parts, and part two begins with my meeting with Armstrong in Austin, because that was the real watershed for Ulrich. That was when the narrative had already started to flip, really, in 1998. But from that point, you know, there was the reality of a guy who was still the second best cyclist in the world, yet he was seen as a disappointment, as someone who was not fulfilling his potential. And some of it was true, in the sense that there was definitely a degree of laziness. I mean, I interviewed Bjarne Riis for the book, and he quite explicitly said to me that, look, riders in that era were lazy because EPO was so powerful, the drugs were so powerful, that they could get away with being lazy. I mean, by the standards of any normal person, it certainly, you know, it couldn't be qualified as laziness. They were still training every day. They were still, you know, going out for 4 or 5 hours at a time, but they were certainly making nothing like the kind of sacrifices that a lot of the pro riders are making today. And with 1999, the tone was set there. The first head-to-head meeting of Armstrong and Ulrich was going to be 2000. And, you know, Armstrong said to me that even he, having won in 1999, was pretty sure that Ulrich was going to be better than him in 2000. And in his training rides leading up to the Tour de France, he was with Kevin Livingstone quite often, and he was saying to Livingstone things like, oh, I'm going to have to work on my descending because Ulrich and Pantani, because Pantani had missed 99, of course, as well, they were going to be back. And Armstrong didn't think he was going to measure up. As he put it to me, it was like, oh, the cancer guy, we let the cancer guy win, but now the real guys are back in 2000. And of course, the reality was that, well, they got to the first big mountain stage of 2000, which was the Stage de Hautacam. And to me, Lionel, I don't know about you, but that was definitely one of the most shocking moments of the Armstrong reign. And I talked about how memorable Ulrich in Andorra was, but Armstrong at Hautacam, and just the way he absolutely obliterated Pantani and Ulrich and the others as well, and just the blitzkrieg, as I call it in the book, that he's this, you know, 110 revs per minute cadence, and just this sort of flash of metal and legs and flesh, and just going away in a blur up this climb, up this, you know, very gloomy, it was a very gloomy day, disappearing into the mist. And that was a really powerful image, and he really, well, he had left them behind definitively, hadn't he, Pantani and Ulrich?
He had, and I mean, Ulrich was the contender, not the champion, for a couple of years. I mean, Armstrong was, as they said, on another planet, but they were all on the same planet, really, weren't they? I mean, Ulrich, I mean, what was the reality of Ulrich and EPO at that point?
Well, what I didn't really go into in the book, because I don't have the expertise, is this question of who reacted best to the drugs. This is something that I know Jonathan Vaughters has spoken about a lot. You know, there are various differences. Well, there's a wide variety of opinions on that. You know, someone with a naturally high hematocrit, were they at a natural disadvantage because they couldn't use a lot of EPO to boost their level up to 50? I'm not sure. The reality is that Ulrich had his induction to EPO. Subsequent expert commission investigation found out or put their best guess at sometime in 1996, before his first Tour de France. And this is what also the telecom soigneur Jeff Dont, who wrote a memoir in 2007, this is what he'd said, that he claimed that he was the first person to give Ulrich EPO, or he was certainly one of the first to administer it to Ulrich, and it was before his first Tour de France. What they were doing thereafter, you know, I heard various stories that there was a team talk before the 1999 season, so the first season post-Festina. They were told not to bring any drugs to races, but this was a sort of veiled warning, and the subtext, certainly some riders took it to mean you can carry on doping, but just keep us out of it or don't do anything dangerous. Again, that's me extrapolating. That's not necessarily the exact words that were used by the team management, but the bottom line was, I think they continued to dope and Armstrong continued to dope. I mean, we know a lot about Armstrong, Armstrong's doping, how he transitioned at certain points from EPO to blood transfusions and then back as well. And there's a lot of detail about this in the book. I mean, there's the post 2006. I mentioned that Jeff Dont's memoirs came out in 2007. This really caused there was already this apocalypse that happened with 2006. Ulrich's reputation completely wiped out when he was identified as being a client of Eufemiano Fuentes, the Spanish gynecologist in Operación Puerto. But then when Dont's memoirs came out in the spring of 2007 with extremely damning allegations, the dominoes just started falling for the whole telecom organization, which had been going since the early 1992, the team had started, and riders started confessing. And there was a week where almost all of the stars of that Tour de France team in 96-97, one after the other, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, they all called press conferences or gave interviews in which they said, look, it's true, we did it, we doped. And then the doctors, Andreas Schmidt and Lothar Heinrich, who'd been at Telecom throughout, and Heinrich was still on board at what was then, or what was soon to become Team Colombia and then Team HTC. And in fact, after 2006, he'd been entrusted with building this new clean team. So he was seen as one of the good guys. He was also exposed by Jeff Dont's book, and he had to confess as well. He had to say that he was instrumental. He was one of the orchestrators behind this doping program that had been going since the 90s, and Andreas Schmidt, the other doctor as well. So it was exposed as having been completely rotten the whole way through. And with Ulrich, there were two layers to it. There was the Freiburg, the internal, the team doping organized out of the University of Freiburg. And then he'd spent a year away from the team in 2003. He'd been at Bianchi. When he came back in 2004, the second layer to his doping was with Fuentes.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Noom, which is a psychology-based app which helped me to lose quite a lot of weight last year. But much more satisfying is the fact that it's helped me to maintain a healthy weight for a number of months now. I went to the Giro d'Italia for 2 weeks, and when I came back, I weighed practically what I weighed when I set off. And that's after a couple of weeks of enjoying all the lovely food and wine in Italy. And I think the reason for that is because Noom has helped to embed some sustainable habits and change some of my behaviours slightly. One of the things that I hadn't realised until I started using the Noom app was that I was just eating far too much. I was clearly exceeding the daily calorie allowance as recommended for a man by the NHS significantly and too frequently. And so that's what led to the weight creeping on. And so I had to nudge myself back in the right direction. And I don't think I could have done that on my own. I needed the Noom app to kind of show me in black and white exactly what I was eating, how many calories I was consuming, and just to kind of redraw in my head the idea of what a healthy main meal should look like, and also nudge me back towards some healthier snacks in between meals. The one thing that really appealed to me was that no food is off limits with Noom. As long as you look at things in the course of a week or a fortnight or a month, you can enjoy all of the things that you normally like to eat. It's just about moderation, really. And that's certainly the message I took from it. And as the weight dropped off and I started to feel better, I obviously recognised the strength in just being much more aware of what I was eating, when I was eating, and why I was eating, really. So if you would like to give Noom a try, go to noom.com/cycle. That's noom.com/cycle.
working for Cycling Weekly and I only was doing a week of the tour, and one of my feature ideas was to ride up Alpe d'Huez in full in full US postal kit. Now we're talking 2001, so the kind of the French-led kind of anti-Armstrong sentiment was, you know, gaining a groundswell.
Yeah, I mean, 1999, so Armstrong's first tour, there'd been a story about the corticosteroid cream, and he'd sort of come through that untarnished to a large to a large degree. And then in 2000, there'd been the story when France TV had followed the US postal staff and they'd seen them dumping bags of medicines by the side of the road, and there was this investigation which established that they'd been using this Actovegin, which was actually illegal, but it was a sort of dubious product. And then 2001 was the tour when Armstrong was outed as being a client of Michele Ferrari, wasn't it,
by David Walsh? Well, he got in front of that story, didn't he?
Yes,
because
he did.
Walsh had the story and as a good journalist should, contacted Armstrong's entourage for comment.
And Armstrong spoke to La Gazzetta, didn't he?
He got the story out first. He controlled the narrative, so to speak. I remember that 2001 season as well. Armstrong had said something at the start of the year about how he wasn't going to race in France at all until the tour. You know, and it was a funny tour that year, wasn't it? The start was strange, wasn't it? It was low key and up in Dunkirk, and it didn't really feel like the Tour de France. But by the time it got to Alpe d'Huez and I was back out there, I mean, the crowds were huge, and I was there in US postal casquette, jersey, shorts, socks even. I even had the black shoes that Armstrong favoured at the time. And I just wanted to gauge the reaction of the fans that I rode up. And I got in equal part, you know, oh, go Lance, and doper, boo, doper. And it was a fascinating sort of socio experiment, I suppose, of, you know, the wisdom of crowds. I went round each bend wondering what sort of reaction I was going to get. And then, of course, the stage itself was, as I say, mind-blowing, really, when, like, you couldn't, one of those days where you couldn't really take in everything that had happened. You know, Ulrich, he was on the back foot there, wasn't he? I mean, it was a kind of hammer blow to the chance that he had to win that tour. And it started to feel at that stage like he wasn't going to get the better of Armstrong, really.
No, and as I say, he'd been fit coming into that tour. He'd looked really, really good. And still, the result was absolutely emphatic. The victory was absolutely emphatic. And then in 2002, Ulrich had further knee problems. He'd already had knee problems in 1999. You know, some of these knee problems, his old coach, Peter Becker, his first coach, he strongly believes that they were linked to his weight and also his penchant for riding these huge gears, which, I mean, you'll remember, Lionel, there was a lot of talk about this, and this really started, or it came to a head in 2001. There was an awful lot of talk about the contrast in the styles, Armstrong with this egg beater, very fast cadence, and Ulrich with this kind of lumbering slow cadence, very big gears. And this was often blamed on Peter Becker, and there was an assumption that this was the dogmatic old modus operandi of East Germany. Peter Becker strongly rejects that, and he actually said that it was a lot to do with ego. And I mean, I make the comparison in the book. I draw the parallel between a lot of people have said this about Tiger Woods, the golfer, and his obsession with hitting the ball a long way, which then caused him injuries. And Peter Becker thought that Ulrich, there was an element of machismo and ego that Ulrich, I mean, we've all, you know, those of us who have ridden a bike a little bit, you know, there is a certain kind of pride that's in being able to push big gears and appearing powerful. And there are those who say that that was the case with Ulrich. Anyway, he developed knee problems early in 2002. He went from specialist to specialist, and his prospects of riding the tour were pretty, pretty bleak. And he started going out more. I think he was drinking more. And there was one night in particular where, well, he crashed into a bike rack outside Freiburg and then tried to sort of escape the scene. And this was obviously a very embarrassing incident. The police were involved. And then shortly after that, a few weeks later, he was on a night out in Munich, and a friend who he's never named, gave him some kind of MDMA pill, ecstasy pill, amphetamine. And the next day, he was tested by the German National Anti-Doping Agency. And there are various conspiracy theories about that test. There are even those who say that it was mandated by Telecom because they wanted him off the books. I put that to a few people in the book or in the course of researching the book, and they're slightly dubious about that. Anyway, the upshot was that it tested positive. He was sort of put on gardening leave by Telecom, and he went for this kind of sabbatical in Canada to kind of get his head straight and reset. And when he came back, he decided that he didn't want to ride for Telecom anymore, and he was going to a new team, a relatively new team. They'd been around for a couple of seasons already, but a team that couldn't have been more different from Telecom, because Telecom were this enormous German institution, one of the biggest companies in Germany. They'd been privatized in the 90s, and they had the biggest marketing budget in Germany, and he was going to this sort of startup team, Coast, which was a very small, a budget high street fashion chain, whose owner seemed to have sort of ideas slightly above his station, big ambitions, but the team had already had financial issues. Anyway, after a few months at Team Coast, the bills weren't being paid, and Ulrich was, well, he was in limbo. He'd been banned for the positive doping test, and he was due to come back in the April, but the team's future was very uncertain. And then Bianchi came on board, and at the last minute, they saved the team. And Ulrich himself came back at the start of 2003, firing on all cylinders. And what was not known at the time was that he'd linked up in his period off, in those few months when he was banned, he'd linked up with the Italian coach Luigi Cecchini, who was infamous at the time. There were two infamous Italian coaches, Michele Ferrari and Luigi Cecchini. They were actually quite different in terms of their approach, I think, to coaching, also in terms of what allegations of doping had actually stuck. Cecchini had been investigated once and nothing was ever really found in 1998. Anyway, Cecchini still didn't have a particularly good reputation, fairly or unfairly, in 2003, and Ulrich hadn't told anyone, or he hadn't said publicly that he was with Cecchini. But he came back being coached by Cecchini and was suddenly riding fantastically. And Cecchini, actually, for the book, I went to see him in Lucca. It was the first interview he'd done for 17 years. And we spoke over a few hours about Ulrich, and that was fascinating.
What were the headlines from that conversation?
Well, the consensus, not only from Cecchini, but also other people, I spoke to a lot of people who have been coached by Cecchini, Tyler Hamilton, Thomas Decker, Jörg Jaksha, was that Ulrich was deeply fond of Cecchini. Cecchini is a very sort of mild-mannered, he's quite a wealthy, stylish, urbane Tuscan gentleman, really, who lives in this beautiful villa just outside Lucca. And Ulrich, I think, was quite taken by all of this. He was quite taken by the whole environment that he sort of found in Tuscany, typical sort of Italian hospitality. When he went to train with Cecchini, it couldn't have been more different from what he'd known in East Germany. You know, the whole family would come out, they'd all sit on this beautiful, around this beautiful table in the garden, and there'd be good wine and good food, and the training was fantastic in Tuscany. And this had somehow resonated, as well as whatever else was going on. What no one really knew and has never been really firmly established, but seems to be the case, was that also in the spring of 2003, Ulrich had started working with Eufemiano Fuentes at more or less the same time that he'd started working with Cecchini. Now, quite a lot of time in the book is devoted to trying to establish whether those two came as a package, Fuentes and Cecchini. The conclusion that I draw, and that all of those riders I mentioned earlier encouraged me to draw, was that actually Cecchini didn't want anything to do with the doping, but he was aware of it, and he was aware of Fuentes' reputation and what he was doing.
And all of the cost of this was being borne by Ulrich?
Yes.
So we've moved from a kind of almost a state or team-sponsored program into a personal program by this stage?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's a really fascinating conversion, isn't it? And an indication of how cycling was changing at the time, and how the kind of the windows of opportunity were being narrowed a little bit, perhaps first of all by the hematocrit rule, which I know, you know, predated a lot of this. But fascinating, the journey that Ulrich was on, and where my kind of sympathies with him lie. But then if you want to go head to head with Armstrong, presumably he would have known what Armstrong was up to. And
well, this was,
I mean, that's
this
a fascinating
really
question.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I asked Armstrong and Brunel directly, do you know that he was with Fuentes? And Armstrong's memory was slightly foggy, but he also said to me on numerous occasions there were no secrets, we knew everything was going on. And he also said that Michele Ferrari knew everything that was going on. Michele Ferrari was a great source of intel about Ulrich. Ferrari would go to spy on Ulrich. This was a story I'd never heard before. Armstrong said that Ferrari would don a disguise and go to spy on Ulrich. For example, when he was riding the Tour of Switzerland, he'd stand at the top of a climb with a, I don't know. I mean, Armstrong literally, I think, said to me, sometimes he might wear a fake moustache or something. And then he would report back, and Armstrong said that Ferrari would know if Ulrich was using one blood bag at the Tour de France, two blood bags, or three blood bags. He never established how Ferrari knew this, but he would know. And whereas Johan Brunel told me that they didn't know that Ulrich was with Fuentes in 2003. And I stress, this is a best guess based on Spanish police documents, German police documents, but it looks as though Ulrich had his first appointment with Fuentes in the spring of 2003. Brunel said to me, had they known, it would have been an extra fear factor for them. They would have been worried because Brunel had had riders on US Postal who had been with Fuentes, and as Brunel put it to me, it was definitely a different level with him. Now, that has to be caveated. Obviously, it's in Armstrong and Brunel's interest to suggest that other riders were at least as bad, if not worse, than Armstrong. However, you know, there was certainly a cavalier side to Fuentes, which I don't think was the case with the telecom doctors, for example. I mean, the telecom doctors, the story of how that doping program grew is a story that I think can probably be applied across a lot of professional cycling. It began with doctors knowing that riders were interested in this substance, EPO, and other substances. They knew that the resistance was probably going to be futile because it made a massive difference to their performances, and the riders wanted it. And initially, that they tried to provide a level of sort of surveillance, supervision, and advice. You know, don't take too much of it, essentially, or take these precautions. And then, in time, that evolved and that changed to the point where they were administering it. They were in some instances suggesting alternatives, and they became very much actors rather than sort of passive observers.
And that 2003 Tour de France, I mean, that was the closest tour it got to beating Armstrong. I mean, it was a great tour, just looked at, you know, in terms of the day-to-day. That time trial you mentioned at Cap Découverte, which was, well, the moment when the possibility of Ulrich winning was, well, it was alive, wasn't it?
Yes, and he should have won that tour. And there were mistakes made. Rudy Pevenage's direct sportif made big mistakes, and he admits them today. That the one of the issues in that tour was Ulrich, and particularly more Pevenage's preoccupation with telecom, because Alexander Vinokourov was also in with a shout to win that Tour de France, and he was close to Armstrong's yellow jersey. I mean, Armstrong did have the yellow jersey, although he was struggling. I mean, Armstrong said that in that Tour de France, and Brunel confirmed this, that there were numerous occasions in the first few days where he went back to the team car and to ask whether his brake pads were rubbing or that whether there was a problem with the bottom bracket. He just did not feel good at all. And Vinokourov looked as though, I mean, he won the stage in Gap, the famous stage where Bilocchi crashed and it almost cost Bilocchi his career. But Vinokourov was one of three riders who looked as though they could win Armstrong, Ulrich and him. And Pevenage became preoccupied, almost obsessed with beating Telecom, the team from which he and Ulrich had come. And on the stage to Ludonvier, there was a moment on the Pyrosaurd where Armstrong and Ulrich were together and Vinokourov was down the road, and Ulrich rode tempo all the way up the climb, as one would if their main concern was stopping Vinokourov from winning the tour, winning the stage and winning the tour, rather than, you know, Armstrong was in the yellow jersey. You always make the yellow jersey ride, and then you attack him if you're in Ulrich's position. But there was also a sense during that tour that Armstrong was subpar, but he was a bit of a sort of stirring giant. And there were people in Ulrich's team who knew this, who sensed this, who feared it, and they were voicing this as well. Look, we have to strike now, because if we leave it, sooner or later we're going to find ourselves facing the real Armstrong, the normal Armstrong, the Armstrong we've seen for the previous few years. And sure enough, as they went through the Pyrenees, that's what happened. He was getting slightly better. And then they got to the stage over the Tourmalet, finishing at Lusard-Ardennes. And it was the old Armstrong. The other contributing factor to it, to Armstrong sort of being resuscitated, I think, was the crash he had where he tangled with a spectator's Musette on the climb to Lusard-Ardennes. And I think he got this huge shot of adrenaline. And it was a script we'd seen many times before. Armstrong just looking peerless and looking as though he was riding he was riding different gears, he was riding at a different pace, he was riding a different climb to Ulrich. And Ulrich suddenly looked leaden and, you know, the same as he'd been for the previous few years.
And he looked kind of leaden, really, in comparison, for the next couple of years, didn't he?
Yeah, then it was an interesting couple of years, which are all sort of condensed into one chapter in the book, and it's a tale of, well, the story is of him going back to T-Mobile. It was called T-Mobile then, the name changed, and it was a team that had become bloated on its own kind of hubris. It had become this enormous behemoth, which had, I think, probably the biggest budget in professional cycling, connections in very high places. It was sort of fetishized by German politicians. They were invited to training camps on hospitality junkets and so on and so forth. And the riders, by a lot of accounts, were quite spoiled. And it wasn't the same Telecom. It was a long way from the Telecom that Ulrich had known when he turned professional. And his love for the sport had also started to dwindle. I mean, he'd grown tired of this narrative of him being an underachiever and of him not being professional. And it started to become, most people would agree, a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And in fact, you know, Brunel said to me that he thought Ulrich was broken after 2003. He was broken psychologically. And although he still finished, you know, he finished third one year and fourth another year, 2004, 2005, he wasn't really close again to beating Armstrong.
And yet, by 2006, after Armstrong had retired, he was one of the two riders most fancied to step in and win the Tour de France, the other being Ivan Basso.
Yeah, the most extraordinary thing is that in 2005, when Armstrong rode out of the Tour and rode out of cycling, you know, if you'd have said to anyone, or if you said to people that out of Ulrich and Armstrong, one of those guys had ridden their last Tour de France, you know, no one would have said that it was Jan Ulrich.
Yeah. And of course, 2006, I mean, Operation Puerto, I mean, it was a maelstrom of of events really that started to accelerate during the Giro d'Italia, wasn't it? When arrests started to be made and the net was closing, the Spanish police were closing in on Fuentes, and the storm that brewed in Strasbourg at the Grand Depart was extraordinary. I mean, you know, the drama of the Tour de France barely matches that kind of... I mean, it's not the drama that we necessarily want to see, but at the time, it was extraordinary. There was a sense of every single card collapsing the couple of days before that start.
It was extraordinary, Lionel, and there was also an extraordinary backdrop in the sense that the Football World Cup was taking place in Germany, and this was, obviously, it was a huge moment for... It would be a huge moment for any country to host the World Cup, but in Germany, it took on, held a particular significance because, well, sociologists have pointed to this fact, and you know, various people confirmed it to me when I spoke to them about 2006 for the book. But it was one of the first moments when, although Germany had been formally unified in 1990, this was one of the first moments when Germans really felt proud to be German. And there was a huge party which had really taken over the whole country. It didn't really matter whether you were from the east or the west. There were German national flags flying in people's gardens, which, as one of the interviewees in the book told me, prior to that moment would have signified that you were a Nazi, basically. And it was the first time where it was seen as okay to do that. So, you know, the World Cup had started in this atmosphere of almost a kind of embarrassment, which had been sort of lurking in Germany, well, certainly since unification and going way back to the end of the Second World War. I mean, there's a lot about this in the book, about how Germany has dealt with the legacy of the Second World War. But, you know, this embarrassment about being German, this uncertainty about what it meant to be German. And there were a lot of articles written on the eve of the World Cup about how the World Cup was going to bring these questions into focus, and how Germany was effectively going to spend a month on the sort of psychoanalyst couch during the World Cup. And, you know, the first game that the Germans played, the national anthem was sort of this kind of dirge rang around the stadium, and no one sang, none of the players sang, and it was all very muted. And then they, you know, they won a couple of games and the atmosphere sort of improved, and then people started to really... you know, belt out the national anthem, and people started to feel a lot more patriotic. And the team as well, it was a team of young players who were quite likable. They sort of expressed themselves well in interviews, and this was just growing. This kind of World Cup fever was growing and growing and growing. And then on the day that Jan Ullrich ended up being kicked out of the Tour de France, Germany were playing Argentina in the quarterfinal, and there were a million people in what they called the fans mile between the victory column in Berlin and a big screen that was erected by the Brandenburg Gate. And Jan Ullrich was where he left the hotel in a place called Blesheim, close to Strasbourg, at about, I think it was 10 to 7 in the evening. And at that exact moment, Miroslav Klose scored the equaliser for Germany against Argentina, and they went on to win that game in a penalty shootout. And that was the last game they won in that World Cup, and they were knocked out in the semi-final. But that was the absolute zenith of, as I said, that sort of that outpouring of pride and togetherness. And, you know, as one of the players, Thomas Hitzlsperger, said, it was the German equivalent of 1968, the Summer of Love. And, you know, everyone felt proud to be German, and everyone was completely caught up in this football fever. And at the same time, you had this guy who had been voted the greatest German sportsman of all time 10 years earlier, not 10 years earlier, just vanishing, completely vanishing. He exited the stage then, and he was never seen at a bike race again.
Well, that was what I was going to say, because my memory of that in Strasbourg was that Ullrich and Telekom went quietly, whereas Basso and CSC and Rees, they kind of kicked their feet. They were kicking and screaming, being dragged out of the Tour de France. They gave the sort of hand-wringing press conference and tried to be reinstated. And whereas Ullrich left with some dignity. I mean, I found that at the time quite incredible, because clearly it was sort of an admission of guilt, but also an admission that, yeah, I'm guilty and I'm tired of this life, really. That's how I interpreted it at the time. You know, he just disappeared from cycling there and then.
Yeah, and he was in incredible form that summer, and he was convinced he was going to win the Tour, and he was going to retire. He was going to win the Tour and retire. He hadn't told anyone this, or he hadn't said it publicly, but he did just completely disappear, and it wasn't reported at the time, but there were lots of conversations about a confession. In 2004, he'd split up with his long-term girlfriend, and he was now with the sister of a teammate, or a former teammate, Tobias Steinhauser. And there were conversations with his partner then at the time about a confession. There were even it could have come as early as one of the rest days in that Tour de France. There was a plan afoot to hold some kind of press conference and to admit everything, but they decided not to do that. And this was the first of a series of rough plans going on for years. There were interviews that were done and they were ready to be published, where he admitted everything, and they were pulled at the last minute. And to this day, he has never really laid everything out and explained everything about what happened.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off everything at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. Science in Sport has everything you need to fuel your ride before, during and after. So that's to improve your performance and aid your recovery. Energy bars, energy gels, tablets that mix up into drinks, powders such as the Beta Fuel. Go to scienceinsport.com, browse through the products and fill up your basket and use the code SISCP25. So Ulrich exited the stage quietly but also dramatically in 2006. And then really wasn't seen until 2015. There were rumours and... But he didn't really, he had no public profile at all in that period.
Not really. I mean, he was almost living in self-imposed exile. He'd moved to Switzerland in 2003, as a lot of German riders have done, well, had done before and have done since. There are tax advantages, but they're also, you know, it's a great place to train. And that kept him, that helped to keep him out of the public eye in Germany. He'd given this absolutely disastrous retirement press conference. So he decided there'd been rumours about him where he certainly tried to contest the allegation. He certainly tried to defend himself against the allegations of doping. The main allegation, obviously, being that he was a client of Eufemiano Fuentes. This was before Jeff Dont's memoirs had been published, because they were published in the spring of 2007. So we're talking about the last months of 2006. It was all to do with Fuentes and Alpares in Puerto. And, you know, the allegations were coming out from various directions. There was the federation, there was a sporting side of it, and there was also a judicial side to it. But despite that, he maintained that he was innocent. He was still talking about coming back. He was still training to a certain extent. But then the German police were demanding, they demanded a saliva sample that was going to be compared, that was going to be cross-referenced with the blood bags found in Spain. And the writing really was on the wall. I mean, he was kind of banged to rights at that point. And then in the February of 2007, he gave this press conference, the retirement announcement, which to this day is a lot of Germans' abiding memory of Ulrich. It was a bit of a disaster. It was a half-hour monologue, and it was a rant. You know, it started with him saying that he was pleased to see some people in the room, but there were other black sheep who he'd rather had stayed away. And it continued very much in that vein, and it was very fractious. And then from that press conference, he went on to one of Germany's top most popular TV chat shows. It's a show called Beckman, and the front man is a guy called Reinhold Beckman. And this, again, Ulrich thought that this was going to be an opportunity for him to get off his chest whatever he wanted to. What he hadn't been told was that he was going to be grilled, or he was going to be asked about doping. He thought he wasn't, there were going to be no, very naively, he thought there weren't going to be any questions about doping. And he was asked, I think the first question was, what do you consider to be doping? And he fell silent for 10, 15 seconds, sort of looked to the ceiling and hesitated, stammered, and gave a terrible, terrible answer, which, as I say, is a lot of Germans' abiding memory of Jan Ulrich. And that really set the tone for the next few years. Whenever, on the rare occasions when he spoke to the press or when he was seen in public, there was a sense, there was a mutual sense of embarrassment, both on his part and the part of whoever it was he was speaking to. And there was no way for him to really reinvent himself or exist in the public eye. And obviously that created, I think, probably financial issues. You know, he still had to earn a living. And in the meantime, there were lots of legal issues arising from both initially Operation Puerto and then post 2000, the spring of 2007, everything that was coming out about Freiburg.
And in the process of writing the book, did you try to speak to Ulrich? Does he know the book's been written?
So in 2015, I went to see his agent in a place called, we had a meeting in a place called Gütersloh, in the middle, well, the sort of north middle of Germany. And I explained what I was doing. And it wasn't a very fruitful meeting. I'd obviously gone there to sort of ask for an interview, and he talked about other plans that they had for a film and other interviews, and you know, there was talk of me possibly having to pay for an interview with Jan, and I hoped that we would eventually get round it. We never did. And then I started to interview other people, and there were quite a lot of people who asked for Ulrich's blessing to do the interview. So he was aware then that I was writing this book, and he gave his blessing to everyone, as far as I know. There were a lot of people who declined to speak to me, who didn't want to speak to me for the book. But whenever, as far as I know, whenever Ulrich was consulted, he said it's fine. But this was pre-2018. And so there are really two phases of kind of researching the book: before 2018, this disastrous summer that he had, and post. And then since then, well, again, he sort of disappeared. I think, as I said before, the events of the summer of 2018, I think most people are aware of some of the details, of breaking into a neighbour's garden, was supposedly under the influence of drugs and alcohol, and then an alleged assault of a woman in Frankfurt. Then after that, there was another period. There's been really, since then, another period of total kind of blackout. Total information blackout. Not many people know anything about what's happened since then. There've been a few stories that he's been doing better, that he'd moved back to the Black Forest where he'd lived for years with his first long-term girlfriend, Gabby. And, well, in the last few months, I've had to do a very sort of delicate dance. Again, also trying to weigh up in my own mind and trying to reconcile with myself why I was writing this book and whether it was going to cause him any problems, because I'm very well aware of the fact that after 2018, I mean, there were people, various people told me that they didn't think he would make it through that summer. And it, by all accounts, since then, it's been very precarious at times. You know, he's had highs and lows, and the situation is still evolving. So since then, you know, I've been talking to people in what he's now his entourage, and these are people who are not really known to most cycling fans. They're old friends. There's a gentleman called Mike Baldinger, who's a former motorcyclist, a former professional motorcyclist, who he's been friends with for many, many years, since he was first in the Black Forest in the 90s. And he has almost taken Ulrich into his kind of care and tutelage. And I've been in contact with them quite a lot and been getting sort of information about what's happening. And also again, trying to assess for my own purposes and for my own kind of conscience what it was responsible to say, to write, and how to go about this sort of last phase. So we're talking about the last, well, the epilogue of the book, really. How to go about it in an intellectually honest but also sensitive way. And again, you know, in March of this year, so I went down to the Black Forest to where Jan is now living, and I met Mike Baldinger, who, as I said, is really his guardian angel now. And Mike said to me, you know, he would have loved for Jan to come and do an interview that day, but again, it was quite a delicate time. There were a few issues this winter again. With there was an incident in Cancun in Mexico, which was reported in the press, but only with very vague details. But you know, the bottom line is, this is not, it's not a happy story, and it's not a happy ending yet. We all sort of hope anyone who has any kind of affection for Jan Ulrich and what he achieved, or anyone with any sort of sense of decency, will hope that there is going to be a happy ending eventually. But it's not, we're not at that point yet. I think it's a hopeful ending. Things are going better for him. But he's not completely out of the woods, I don't think.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.